Saturday, September 25, 1971. In Ireland, two British soldiers were shot by members of the IRA. Part of the city Dublin was going up in flames, and English sappers were destroying the bridges between Northern Ireland and the Irish Free State. Bands of guerrilla warriors were going out on patrol from Bengal in India to Bangladesh or East Pakistan, destroy what they could of the transportation and of the commerce of that poorest portion of our world. And the armies of India and Pakistan were on their way to a war footing. In Southeast Asia, the North Vietnamese were shelling several American fire bases near Cambodia. The Viet Cong were mortaring American bases in South Vietnam, and American bombers were flying retaliatory missions against the North Vietnamese north of the demilitarized zone. Along the Suez, bristling with guns, there was a temporary hiatus, temporary ceasefire. Russian manned faster than sound jets, which flew up the Mediterranean coast that day within 30 seconds of Tel Aviv. And the Security Council of the United Nations met in emergency session in New York City, an urgent session so urgent that the diplomats could be summoned from their families and from their golf games on the Saturday, so urgent that one of the parties to the dispute could not be present at the beginning of the debate because it had to be called on the Sabbath. The Israeli ambassador could not be present until the Sabbath was over. Israel stood accused before the Security Council of heinous crimes, violation of the Charter of the United Nations, of being, by these actions, a threat to world peace. Now, the United Nations has never once discussed or debated the substantive issues involved in Ireland. The United Nations has dealt with some of the refugee problems, the humanitarian problems involved in India and between India and Pakistan, but has never once raised the political issues which threaten to throw that subcontinent into a state of war. The United Nations has never once debated, God forbid, the martial mobilization of Chinese and Soviet divisions, some 40 divisions across the Manchurian border. For the moment, Vietnam and Southeast Asia was not on the United Nations agenda. But Israel was. And at the end of this day of urgent discussion, Israel stood condemned, and I quote, of actions designed to change the status of the Israel-occupied section of Jerusalem, including expropriation of land and property, transfer of population, legislation aimed at the incorporation of the occupied sector. Somehow these actions, expropriation of land and property, transfer of population, legislation aimed at the incorporation of the occupied sector, involved the most urgent threat to peace then before the most august body in our world. Now, what specifically does Israel stand condemned of? Let's look at the issues seriatim, one by one. Expropriation of land and property. Now, this phrase evokes memories of the expropriation of the land and the property, not to speak of the lives of the Jews of Europe by the Nazis, of the land and the property of the Jews of most of the Near East by the Arabs, of the great billions of dollars of foreign investment by many of the colonial powers, by the newly independent powers of the world, the expropriation of the land and the property of landowners and mujiks in Russia and in Eastern Europe by the communists. When all is said and done, this phrase so heavy and portentous of meaning, expropriation of land and property, is discovered to define and to describe nothing more than a minor urban renewal and relocation project in the city of Jerusalem. In the old city of Jerusalem, some 300 Arab families lived in the Mograbi section in hovels, hovels which were so poor and so mean that they violated every one of the health and safety requirements of the municipality of Jerusalem. Hovels worse than anything that exists in our city, without running water, without a toilet, without room, air to breathe, without a window for which the air can come in. And the Israeli authorities found that they could no longer tolerate this threat to the health of their city, to the health of its citizens in their midst. And so they provided for these 300 families new housing in Jerusalem, but elsewhere. And they repaid the slum lords who had owned this land for generations, who turned out to be some members of the Arab nobility of Morocco. They paid them many times the worth of this property. And they tore these hovels down and planned to rebuild them with decent and appropriate living spaces. And the second phase of this plan involved the removal of some 3,000 Arab families from land owned by Jews in the old Jewish quarter of East Jerusalem, land which had been expropriated from their Jewish owners by the Arab Legion in 1947 and 1948, when it had violated the will of the United Nations and attacked the city which the United Nations had declared to be an internationalized place. These dwelling places, for the most part, poor hovels, tenement slums, were razed. New housing will be rebuilt on the space, and the 3,000 families were relocated in new housing, and all expenses were paid for their removal to this housing. And the third item in this urban renewal project, which was deemed worthy of condemnation by the United Nations, involved the removal of 300 Jewish families and some 350 Jewish shopkeepers from an area just inside the old Jaffa Gate, where there was some decent housing, but where there was a need for roads and some new municipal buildings, and where it was felt that this Jewish population would have to put up with the inconvenience of being moved to other locations, and they too, of course, were recompensed. Now, one can question in any major city the advisability of this or that urban renewal program. None can be initiated of any size without destroying something of the ethnic identity, of the sense of community, which even the poorest community in the city has. But when there is a clear threat to health and safety, when it's a question of changing medieval slums into modern apartment living, then certainly a community has the right to decide what needs to be done for the well-being of its citizens. This particular program was debated by the municipality of Jerusalem, on whose council sit both Arabs and Jews, and was deemed appropriate and fitting for the city. So much for the charge of the expropriation of land and property. Now, what of the charge of transfer of populations? Well, obviously, it involves the transfer of these people who had been moved from these hovels and tenements to new housing. The total number, perhaps 9,000. Not a great number. Obviously, there is something more, however, implicit in this charge, which came out in the discussion that day at the United Nations, when any number of Latin American and states in Europe and elsewhere which have church states began to speak of the threat of the Israeli occupation to the Christian populations of the land. Now, the facts are these. In 1948, the city of Jerusalem had a Christian population of some 25,000. By 1967, the Christian population of Jerusalem had been reduced by people leaving to 10,800. But that entire loss took place in the eastern section of Jerusalem. And once Jerusalem was reunited in 1967, the curve began to swing back. Today, instead of 10,800 Christians living permanently in Jerusalem, there are some 12,500, and more are settling there every month. What is involved then in the charge which seems to emanate from missionary and other circles in Jerusalem that somehow the Jews are making it difficult for the Christians in Jerusalem? I think the charge rests largely on two counts. The first is that the Jews have, in fact, made it very difficult for very many of these missionary societies to do, quote, their good work. For centuries now, many of the brotherhoods and convents which have existed in Jerusalem have given bread and food, some meager rations, have provided some clinic facilities, a meager education to the impoverished in the old city. These have been their flock, their justification for being, their good works, and in that sea they have fished for their souls. And now the Jews have come along and brought urban renewal and brought social welfare and broken the chain of poverty. And now this population no longer needs the Christian spirit of these good fathers and good sisters. And they are frustrated. There is no longer reason for their being, for their doing. Where shall they find their good work? Where shall they give Christian charity? We have made it difficult for Christianity in this medieval sense to exist, to perpetuate itself in Jerusalem. And the second reason for the frustration of these groups in Jerusalem lies really in the fact that Jerusalem has now become a living city. It's no longer an antique. It's no longer a shrine, a mausoleum. It is now a living place. The figures speak for themselves. In 1948, there were 100,000 Jews in Jerusalem. By 1967, there were 195,000 Jews in just the Jewish or Western sections of Jerusalem. In 1948, there were 65,000 Arabs and Christians, Arabs rather, in East Jerusalem. In 1967, there were 65,000 Arabs in East Jerusalem. There had been no addition. There had been no economic growth. There had been no change. These monasteries and convents had been allowed to continue in the assumption that everything in the Middle East was as it had been before, that change, the 20th century technology advancement, that all this had not come. And now suddenly, with the reunification of Jerusalem, the bustle of the West, the change of the West, the science of the West, the economics of the West have come in. And now suddenly they face a population which is no longer a population of the poor and of the beggars and of those who live on charity and the storekeepers who cater to the European middle class. Now they must cater to a population of people on the move, changing, progressing, developing, moving into the modern world. And that's very difficult. People whose institutions, whose ways of life have fossilized there in the East for the last several centuries. Now, the concern used to be the concern about shrines and about holy places. Jerusalem is a shrine, has in it many shrines. The history is clear. In 1948, once the ceasefire was effected, the Arab occupiers of East Jerusalem immediately put restrictions on ingress to these holy places. The Israelis could not come to them. Even an Israeli Arab could not cross the line and worship at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And no Jew could go to the Wailing Wall. And of the 54 synagogues which existed in the old city of Jerusalem, which were not part of the ceasefire line as far as Israeli territory was concerned, of those 54 synagogues, every single one was either demolished or destroyed or burned or vandalized. The old Karaite synagogue, which had been in use for 1,000 years, was leveled to the ground. There's a synagogue in Jerusalem called Tiferet Israel. It bears our own name, or we bear its name. It was an old Hasidic center, a great one. It had one of the finest Hasidic and Kabbalistic libraries in the world. If you go to look for the Tiferet Israel congregation, which had been in being for 300 years, you'll not find a single stone on a single stone. The books were burnt. There's not a single remnant of the library. Of the desecration of the cemeteries and the Mount of Olives and Mount Scopus, you know well. And the Arab contempt for the Jewish holy places extended not only to the synagogues and to the cemeteries, but even to the institutions of learning and of healing. For all the years of Arab occupation, the buildings of the Hebrew University in Mount Scopus, the library of the Hebrew University in Mount Scopus, the Hadassah Hospital in Mount Scopus, was shuttered tight, open to no one. When the Israelis reoccupied Jerusalem in 1967, they passed immediately a law which gave to the traditional sects which controlled each shrine control over the shrine. The Supreme Muslim Council of Jerusalem controls the Dome of the Rock. The Franciscan Order and the Sisters of Mercy control their respective shrines. There's been no violation of their sanctity. Money has been given for their refurbishment. Any number of building projects which were in abeyance during the entire Arab control have been begun again. And most significant of all, and incredibly, the Jews have opened their borders so that any Arab from any place in any Arab country, except obviously an armed guerrilla, can cross over the Jordan River or land at Haifa or land at Lida and go to the Dome of the Rock, go to the Al-Aqsa Mosque or any place else of a religious nature in Israel he wishes to go to and worship there. There has been complete openness of access to the shrine. Obviously, what Israel has done in Jerusalem does not substantially, on prima facie basis, seem to represent a threat to peace. The real concern of the United Nations was not in the expropriation of land and property or the transfer of population, but in the last clause, legislation and actions aimed at the incorporation of the occupied sector. It has been the determined position of these nations that somehow or other, the way to solve the crisis of the Middle East is to return the Middle East to the conditions that existed there before May of 1967. Israeli withdrawal. And if there Israel withdraws to these 1967 boundaries and withdraws simply for some vague words about non-belligerency, well, that's no skin off any diplomat's nose. And if the Arabs mean withdrawal not just from the rest, from the territories conquered in 1967, but from all Arab lands defined as Haifa and Jaffa and Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, as well as the West Bank and the Golan Heights and Sinai, well, again, that's another crisis way down the line. And if Israel is weakened in facing that crisis, well, again, that's no skin off any other diplomat's nose. The Middle East, as many countries look upon it, must be returned to the status quo ante, the boundaries which existed before 1967. And there's a very convenient moralism which they tend to spout and which has a seeming credibility to it, that there must be, and there is obviously an inadmissibility of acquisition of territory by war. That phrase appears again and again in UN documents. It appears in the resolution of November of 1967, which was an attempt to create a basis around which peace negotiations might begin. The inadmissibility of acquisition of territory by war. Now, it's a pious phrase. And I'm all for pious phrases, if in fact they have some relevance to the situation. But if the world wants to return all territory acquired by war, then we have to return this country to the Indians. And the Soviet must return all the rest of Russia to the Uzbeks and to the Turks and to the Ukrainians. And the English should return Great Britain to the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes. Obviously, all land which is now owned by some country was conquered from someone else. It's only how recent or how unexpected and how weak that conqueror may seem in the eyes of other nations in this world. It ill befits any nation to preach the inadmissibility of acquisition of territory by war. But obviously, everyone wants peace somehow in the Middle East. And obviously, this phrase is a nice catchphrase which can be used to uninvolved audiences with full marks for concern for peace and for justice and for international amity and friendship, and which can be exploited by the Arab world as the first step in the weakening of Israel, the return of Israel to those unfortunate, curved, difficult to maintain borders of 1967, which were never designed to be borders in the first instance, which were in fact simply the ceasefire lines at the end of the Arab-Israel War of 1948. If we want to speak of secure, recognizable, meaningful borders, we must recognize one fact: no such borders exist in that part of the Middle East. When Rome ruled the Middle East, this territory, Judea, was ruled from Caesarea. It included Judea and the Galilee and Transjordan, the Golan, and part of Syria. When the Turks ruled this part of the Middle East, they ruled it from Beirut. The Violette of Beirut, it was called. And it included parts of Lebanon, parts of Syria, Transjordan, Israel as far as Jerusalem and Jaffa, but South Israel, the Sinai and the Negev, was ruled from an Egyptian center. When the British were granted in 1921 a mandate by the League of Nations over Palestine, that mandate included Israel and Jordan, not only the West Bank of the Jordan possession, but also the East Bank as far as the wilderness, the desert of Asia. There's never been a clear boundary in the Middle East as far as Israel or Palestine or the Holy Land is concerned. And what the diplomats of the world forget is that as often as they cite the November 22nd resolution of the United Nations, of the General Assembly, Resolution 242, which begins with a phrase about speaking which speaks of the inadmissibility of acquisitions of territory by war, what they forget is the 40 days of discussion which led to this particular document, which saw coupled in this document the requirement that two things shall happen at once: the withdrawal of Israel from territories occupied by war, and the establishment of conditions of peace, the recognition of the nations, each nation in that part of the world, of all other nations, the establishment, they use the phrase, of peaceful and secure boundaries. And the phrase was deliberately chosen to imply that the boundaries which had existed before 1967 were not necessarily the boundaries which were secure. And there was a great deal of conversation implicit in the document about the rectification of boundary lines so that there could be a more easy, better, more geographically meaningful boundary between Israel and her neighbors. The question of the boundaries in the Middle East is a difficult one. And those who seek to find peace simply by insisting on an Israeli roll back to the boundaries of 1967 commit two sins. The first of the sin is simplicity. They assume that what has happened can simply be undone. They assume that once a war has occurred,
that war, one can continue to exist as if that test of force had simply not occurred. And that fact has never occurred in the history of the world. And their second sin is the sin of blindness. They hear and see what they want to see. They see Arab documents which say that the precondition of peace is the withdrawal of Israel from all Arab lands. The Arabs have not once said the precondition of peace is the withdrawal of Israel from territory occupied in 1967. Arab lands is a code word. It's a code word which means all of the Middle East. It implies not only the West Bank, not only Golan, not only Sinai, not only Gaza, but all that is today Israel. And what occurs is a temporary joining of forces of the peace-loving and of the war-loving, because obviously an Israel driven back, pushed back into the borders of 67 is a weaker Israel. An Israel with fewer buffer zones, an Israel with longer borders, an Israel whose cities are closer to ground-to-ground missiles and to cannon than an Israel with the borders which she has enjoyed since 1967. And Jerusalem, the capital, and the issues which involve Jerusalem have their own complexity, but they tend to highlight better than any other issue the problems involved in this simplistic and blind attempt to bring peace into the Middle East. Let me review for you the condition of Jerusalem. Jerusalem has never been the capital of Palestine, of Israel, of the Holy Land, except when Jews occupied the land. The Jews had their capital in Jerusalem. The Romans had their capital in Caesarea. The Arabs had their capital in Damascus and in Baghdad. The Turks had their capital in Beirut. Only the Jews established their capital in Jerusalem and sought to reestablish their capital there. To the Jew, Jerusalem is the heart of the Holy Land. He had no geography in mind when he went back to Israel. Zionism implies Mount Zion, and Mount Zion is the Mount of Jerusalem. And when on Passover the Jew said to himself, I pray I will return to the Holy Land, he didn't use those vague phrases. He said, L'shana haba'a b'Yerushalayim, next year may we be in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was the heart from which everything pulsated. Here was the temple, here was the shrine, and this is not mere theology. This is not mere, you know, doctrine in a book. Every Jew sensed the truth of this in May of 1967 when the city was reunited. When the soldiers, the kibbutzniks, those who had been the Canaanites, those who had been raised in an anti-religious, non-religious surroundings, went into the old city, they wept. This somehow is part of the heart and the substance of our being. And when Jews visit Israel now, they know that when they visit Jerusalem, there's something very different in the air, very different in our reactions to that city than to Haifa, than to Tel Aviv, than to Beersheba, than to any other place in the land. Now, Jerusalem was designed to be, by the United Nations partition decision in 1948, a corpus separatum. A separate place, an internationalized place under the control of a United Nations authority. So it was voted. And immediately upon the vote, the Yishuv said, aye, we will accept, though we regret. And the Arabs said, nay, we will not tolerate the Dome of the Rock, the El-Aqsa Maxis, third holiest city in Islam, to be taken from us. And the Arabs, Jordanian Arab Legion, came marching into Jerusalem to claim it for its own. And then you recall in November of 1947, the Iriyah, the municipality of Jerusalem, the Jewish community, made an urgent appeal to the United Nations, send troops, come help us. We are being besieged, we are being slaughtered. And this message was never answered. And there's an old principle in law that territory which you make no attempt to sustain, to maintain in its security, you lose title to. Nevertheless, after the bitter fighting of 1947-1948, in which 2% of the entire Jewish population of Jerusalem, man, woman, and child, lost their lives, after the city was split by the ceasefire line, the Trusteeship Council of the United Nations made another attempt to consider the internationalization of Jerusalem, and the Jordanian government said, nay, nay, nay. The Israeli government made some counter-proposals, but these were not accepted, and the issue was allowed to drop. And never once during the entire period of the Jordanian occupation did the United Nations occupy itself with the status of Jerusalem. Never once during all of those years did the United Nations bestir itself because of the patent evidence of the destruction of the synagogues, of the destruction of the cemeteries, of the contempt with which the Arabs were treating the religious desires of Jews and others to go and to worship at their shrines. Never once. But let Israel come into sovereignty in Jerusalem, and immediately there's a cry. Immediately the world believes that now Israel must abide by some rule that no other country seems to be required to abide by. Now, in 1947 and 48, the Church, the Vatican, was particularly insistent upon the internationalization of Jerusalem. That's why the original partition scheme required it, because all the Latin states insisted on it as their quid pro quo for voting for partition. Catholic Church could not bring itself to accept the idea of a new Jewish presence in Jerusalem. Why not? Could the Jews have defamed, disgraced the shrines any more than the Arabs over the centuries had done? So concerned had the church been once by the way the Arabs were managing the holy places of Jerusalem that they had waged for three centuries a holy crusade to redeem them. But somehow, without any evidence, we Jews were not to be trusted. But that's really not the point. Within what Jews Isaac has called the teaching of contempt, within the traditional theological assumptions which the medieval church has taught Catholics the world over for centuries, there is not only the charge that Jews are guilty of deicide, of having killed the Christ, but there is the charge that all Jews in all ages are somehow to be punished for that crime, and that we were dispersed because of that sin. Rome destroyed Jerusalem in the year 70, presumably because Jews had destroyed Christ 40 years before. And we were dispersed and sent wandering and meant to live a life as outcasts, as pariahs, as people who are beyond the law, beyond contempt, until the second coming. And the idea that Jews could reestablish a land, more, that Jews could reestablish Jerusalem as a thriving city, that Jews were people who were still alive and vibrant, who were not outcasts, who were not socially outside the bounds of the law, who were not to be people for whom you could only have contempt. This teaching, this understanding has come very hard to many among the more conservative in the Catholic and Protestant tradition. The church has had a great deal of difficulty accepting patent evidence of how well the Jews have maintained and provided for the shrines compared to how others have done so. And it comes as quite a revelation to liberal clergy when they visit the United City of Jerusalem and they see the meanness and really the coarseness of some of the so-called religious orders who manage the Christian shrines. And they compare this concern with money, with milking the tourist, with icons and idols and foolishness of all kinds. They compare that with their own feelings of religious concern. And they come back, at least with some appreciation of what Israel means and has meant and of the protection and security that it has given. Jerusalem, then, is the issue. Because in Jerusalem, about Jerusalem, there hover all of the concerns, all of the levels of involvement which make the Middle East such a difficult place to even conceive of how peace might be arranged. There is on one level the teaching of contempt, the traditional concern of the world that the Jew is not a human being, not to be trusted, the inability to accept that we are strong and erect and people of this century. And somehow that colors all that many nations, the diplomats of many Western nations feel about the Middle East. There are two standards, one for the Arab, one for the Jew. And then in Jerusalem, beyond the concern for the shrines, there is the concern for the continuance of a way of life which has long since become archaic, where colonial populations depend upon the goodwill of missionary and church institutions. And beyond that, there is a different valence, the different degree of involvement of people in a particular place. To the Jew, Jerusalem is the heart of the state. To a Christian, Jerusalem is a place where a holy biography played itself out. There are shrines there dealing with the Christ, but the center city for the Catholic is Rome, and the center city for many Anglicans is Canterbury, and for many French Catholics is Lourdes. Jerusalem is only one of many sacred places. For the Muslim, the sacred city is Mecca, not Jerusalem. Jerusalem has shrines, but is not the place of pilgrimage. For the Jew, Jerusalem is the center. And to give up Jerusalem for some words, to give up Jerusalem for some vague pledge of peace, this is inconceivable to the Jewish soul. It would be cutting out the soul from the body. It is something which is non-negotiable because it's emotional, because it's spiritual in basis. It's not simply another piece of real estate. This is in the reading that I gave you, I read to you this morning from Heschel. It's the very heart and soul of our Jewish religious being. And that's the problem in the Middle East. We are not dealing with neat pieces of property with pieces of paper which you can divide in any number of ways and make all partners in a business deal feel that they have been satisfied. You're dealing with feeling. You're dealing with emotion. You're dealing, particularly on the part of the Arab world, with deliberately contrived passion. For 30 years and more now, the propaganda mill of every radio in the Near East has been spewing out the hate of, fear of the Jew, fear of Israel. And these things will not simply dissipate, disintegrate, not be there because some diplomat wants a neat solution to the Middle East. My own feeling is this, that the problems of the Middle East defy solution, and that the first truth about dealing with the Middle East requires an acknowledgement of that fact. We are children of the West. The West has been prosperous, and we are children then who are by nature optimistic. We have learned that in technical matters, almost every problem can be solved. But in human matters, I think we're beginning to learn that most human problems defy solution. We change, times change, but the problems are not solved. The problems remain. And I think even in our social context, we're becoming much less optimistic of the ability of man to solve his problems, to create a gracious and amenable society. I have very little optimism about any quick solution to the problems in the Middle East, because the passions will remain. Because we're dealing now with the historic heart of two peoples, Arab and Jew. And because the geography is simply not broad enough to accommodate both the needs of both. And I suspect that given that fact, those who are most urgent for peace are actually counterproductive. They're actually exacerbating the issue by trying to force people to sit down and to barter away that which is not the main issue. You can't barter away your spirit, your soul. You can barter away land, you can sign a compact, but the best treaty in the world is a scrap of paper if someone wants to take it and tear it up. Hitler showed us that in the Ruhr, the Tsar. He showed us that in Danzig and in Poland. It doesn't matter ultimately what you have in paper, it's what's in a nation's heart, where that nation is moving, what moves it. And hate and fear move the Arab world. Concern and fear move the Jewish world. For a while, I think we're all going to have to accept palliative, partial solutions. We'll have to gain time until a new set of forces appear in the world, until a new set of possibilities emerge into the Middle East. Any program designed to force Israel to withdraw to the borders of 1967 now, or 6 months from now, is bound to fail. Fail because the Israeli population cannot abide that kind of danger emotionally. Fail because the Arab appetite will not be satisfied with that vorspeise, with that appetizer. It wants the main meal, the destruction of the Jewish state. Perhaps in the long run there may be no accommodation. But I suspect the diplomats of the world, if they wanted really to establish peace in the Middle East, could do so in one way. And that's if in the détente, the assumed détente between the Soviet Union and the United States of America, they arrange to cease to pour billions of dollars of sophisticated weaponry into that part of the world. Without the weapons, and without the Soviet pilots, and without the Soviet tank captains and cannonators, the Arabs could not wage war on Israel. And without the Russian pilots, and without the Russian tank captains, and without the Russian cannonators, Israel would be no danger to any existing Arab state. If only they would stop pouring into the Middle East the most sophisticated weaponry the world possesses, giving to the highly volatile governments in Cairo, in Baghdad, in Damascus, in Amman, push-button control of supersonic weapons of war. Then perhaps we could buy the time, which would make it possible for peace, for the conditions of peace, to slowly emerge in the Middle East. But if Russia continues to use Egypt and Syria to her own purposes, to further her own expansion southward, because she sees a chance to bloody America's nose, if America is so concerned with peace that she continues to withhold counterbalancing weapons from Israel, war is inevitable. Weapons either are used or they rust. And generals become very insistent when they see their weapons beginning to grow obsolete. They want to use them. They want to prove their glory and their honor and their technical skill. And the passions are there. They could be easily tapped by any demagogue or leader. The Middle East requires now a breathing spell. And that breathing spell can be gained for the Middle East only if the great powers somehow agree that they will cease to make the Middle East the point of confrontation between their forces. Will this happen? Who knows? Russian ambition is, it seems, as endless and as global as American ambition once was. Russia has not yet had her Vietnam. Will it happen? It is not clear yet whether or not the United States is willing to make significant declarations of concern with Israel's inviolability. If Russia and Egypt and Syria, her minions, feel that Israel can be leaned on, and ultimately America will not lean against, they will lean harder and harder, for a little country must ultimately break under the force of greater powers. If America is willing to put her power in the balance so that hopefully she can arrange with Russia some detente, then perhaps we will have months and years of non-peace. Non-peace is better than bloodshed. Jerusalem, the city of peace, may it not be again a city of war. Amen.